So I'm so happy to be here. I'm very touched to be here because, like, you know, I was hearing about Tara Brach before I even started practicing Buddhism. So to be invited into this space is like heartwarming. And also, you know, like I'm a Zen teacher, so I've been invited to teach at Insight Place. And I also really appreciate that. Sometimes we can kind of get in our little narrow roads, and it can be useful to be in our narrow roads. Sometimes I need a sort of a clear, consistent body of teaching, or I need a group of people, and that kind of holds me and keeps me safe. But that tendency can get very stultifying, so I appreciate being invited into this space, and I hope to take that impulse home into the Zen Center where I teach and bring in, you know, we bring in teachers from other traditions, and I think ultimately that's helpful. So I'm going to talk about mindfulness and intimacy. And I know you might think, well, this guy wants to talk about mindfulness and intimacy because he wrote a book called Mindfulness and Intimacy, which is true, but it's more true that I want to talk about mindfulness and intimacy because I wanted to talk about mindfulness and intimacy, so I wrote a book, and that would enable me to talk about it. Because mindfulness and intimacy individually are things that I deeply value and have been really transformative aspects of my life. And I really want to encourage people to turn their attention to these particular things and investigate them in their lives. Because I think, you know, we can focus on all kinds of things with our lives. But I think if we focus on these two things, it can really help. There is a lot of suffering in this world, and people have a lot of ideas about what to do, but I think these things can really help. So I'm just going to begin by reading the first paragraph of the chapter on mindfulness from this book, and then the first paragraph from the chapter on intimacy, just to give you a sense of like where I'm coming from on these subjects. Mindfulness is being aware of things in the present moment in a way that promotes well-being. To practice mindfulness is to choose some aspect of our experience and focus attention there in a sustained way. There is discernment in mindfulness, but it is non-judgmental. It is kind. It allows the mind to rest in the phenomena of the present moment and take a break from creating a relentless stream of imaginations about the future, reviews of the past, or judgments of the present. Our awareness is one of the most amazing and powerful things we have as human beings. Rather than taking it for granted and allowing it to focus wherever the mind's habits choose, with mindfulness we can better focus awareness on things that are truly beneficial. Intimacy, in its simplest definition, means close familiarity and friendship. Words, however, have power and meaning beyond their definitions. No matter what the dictionary says, some words evoke very different meanings or feelings to different people. To some folks, the word religion evokes inspiration, warmth, and wonder. To others, constriction and closed-mindedness. Intimacy is a word a bit like this. It can evoke feelings of connection and safety, but for some people, it's pretty scary or stickily sentimental. And then there are the folks who think it just means sex. You will be very disappointed in this talk, if that's why you came here. Here, I will be pointing towards a way of understanding and experiencing the word intimacy that fosters compassion, calm, and joyful action. I use intimacy here as we often use it in Zen discourse. It's about harmony between autonomy and interdependence. In intimacy, we are individuals who are connected, and we are also one undivided whole. We can develop both healthy boundaries and healthy boundarylessness. So the way I'm talking about mindfulness is pretty conventional. It's just based in my study and practice with early Buddhist texts on mindfulness, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra and the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutra and related literature. The way I'm talking about intimacy is a little less conventional. It's fairly conventional in Zen discourse, but it's not so conventional otherwise. So remember, intimacy just means close familiarity and friendship. So from a Mahayana Buddhist perspective, and I come from a Mahayana tradition, One of the main points of emphasis of the tradition is that everything arises interdependently. The dependent arising of things is part of all Buddhist traditions, but it's emphasized in the Mahayana. So this is to say that each thing is entirely dependent on each other thing and everything else. So there's lots of ways to think about this. In terms of your experience, I can quote Maya Angelou, who once wrote, "You are the sum total of everything you've seen, heard, tasted, smelled, been told, and forgot. It's all still there." But this is actually too small for the Buddhist frame, which really says that the way everything is formed by infinite conditions, Buddha frequently referring to those conditions as without discoverable beginning. So he doesn't bother saying it's infinite, because that would be hard to figure out. He says, can't find the beginning, so don't worry about it. Some people are really sciencey. You have the people who are like, I only want to do Buddhism if it's very sciencey. So we have Carl Sagan, the great famous physicist, once said, if you would like to bake an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the entire universe. Because you might be like, well, not only did I bake the pie, I even grew the apples. Very impressive. But were you the first person to figure out how to cultivate apples in Sumeria 6,000 years ago? I doubt it. And a lot of conditions had to happen for that to happen. And you can go on and on and on. So you could talk forever listing things on which any individual thing depends, and you could talk till the end of your life, until the end of time, and you would never have run out of things. And that's for each individual thing. So things are like this. That means what we are comes from infinite conditions, and everything we do influences everything. Our impacts are infinite. Why am I talking about this? Because I don't know how things could be more intimate than being entirely dependent on each other all the time. That sounds like the most intimate things could possibly be. So when I talk about intimacy, what I mean is how things actually are. So reality is intimacy. And this is not innovative on my part. This is sort of Zen style. So reality is intimacy, but we often don't experience it that way. We experience the universe as being made up of all these discrete things that bump up against each other and are aggravating, and we want to manipulate. Or, I don't want to speak for you. I'm sure you never have that happen. There's various reasons why I wanted to talk about mindfulness and intimacy and explore it and carry this idea around. One of them is that, as you may be aware, we are living in the amazing time of the mindfulness movement. You could have skipped coming here because you probably could have gone to the grocery store and just got the Time or the Newsweek mindfulness supplement for the month, which is on the rack at your local grocery store. Or maybe you could have just gone to InShape magazine and got the Mindful Rock Hard Abs article. That doesn't actually exist yet, but I'm pitching it. Anyway, so there's just something going on. If you look at public discourse, mindfulness is being talked about all over the place. When I read wellness articles, I'm making this number up, but I swear a third of the articles I read at some point will mention you should do meditation or mindfulness, or it'll describe some activity, which is mindfulness, but they don't name it that way. So it's having this big influence in the culture, and I hope this is good. I provide secular mindfulness training, so I participate in the world of secular mindfulness, and I hope it's beneficial. But there are some things that it's really important to be careful about. We might start to think, because mindfulness is being taken up into this very individualistic culture in the West, that mindfulness is like a self-improvement activity. And it's just really important to remind ourselves that mindfulness was designed as a way to see that you don't have a self. That's the basic thing that it's a tool for. So self-improvement really isn't the idea. And more importantly, mindfulness, the reason you want to see through the self is because if you see through the self, you recognize your intimacy with everything. And that's liberative. That's a way of liberation. So mindfulness can start to look, it's like you read these articles or this culture starts to permeate with this idea that everyone should just get up in the morning, put in their app, and they do their thing, and they'll be a little better, and then it's great. Which is kind of true. It's cool. But, you know, Audre Lorde, one of my heroes, once wrote, "Without community, there is no liberation." And she's pointing towards a truth that is fundamental to the idea of why mindfulness came to be. That this is not something that is to be done all alone. It's done in sangha, in community, with a heart that's about supporting everyone. By the way, in that quote, Audre Lorde says, "Without community, there is no liberation. But liberation must not mean a shedding of our differences, nor the pretense that those differences do not exist." And this harkens back to the same idea of how intimacy is understood in Mahayana literature, as we are undivided, and yet we are autonomous individuals who are distinct. So identity is not destroyed by intimacy. Identity is affirmed, and yet there's something else that's also intimate with it, which is some wholeness, interdependence. So another kind of extending on this with the mindfulness movement, you know, I got hired by agencies to go and provide mindfulness training, and they said, "I hope it's beneficial. I try and do it in a way that's useful." But there's a critique that's coming into the world that I think is very good to pay attention to. And that is that we're going to develop a mindfulness movement in the United States that is kind of like you go to your job and they're like, "You know, we want to get everyone to do the mindfulness because they'll just chill out and they'll be less reactive and they'll be more productive and they'll just get along within this system that we have way better." Right? So you're sitting around at your corporation, well, you've got productivity, that sounds good, getting along with the system. Well, I'm just going to tell you, I have no interest in a mindfulness movement that promotes people getting along with the system that we have right now. We live in the United States in a country that is and has always been characterized by white supremacy and patriarchy. We live in a time when Islamophobia and anti-Semitism are on the rise. Homophobia, transphobia are very prevalent. And we have a system of consuming and producing goods that is destroying our family, animals, trees, human beings, cultures. I don't want to just get along. There's something more than just getting along. Mindfulness is based in a tradition that says there's suffering in the world and you can do something about it. That's the fundamental teaching of Buddhism. There's suffering in the world, and you can do something about it. Take the Four Noble Truths. How small can you make them? So wonderful. You can do something about it. Every single moment, if you have consciousness, you have liberative capacity. And then, you know what? I get really excited about this because I just get excited. I don't know. Maybe I'm a bad Buddhist. And then people start to go, "Oh, my God, the pressure. I don't want to liberate everyone. That's too hard." But then if you look at the mode, how does Buddhism uphold the idea of liberation? It's through slowing down. Slow down. Learn to be aware of what's driving your own behavior using mindfulness. And make a really radical transformation. So the basic framing of this, I have my own language that I'm using, mindfulness and intimacy, but the basic framing of this actually comes from an ancient Buddhist tradition of which I'm a devotee, which is called Yogacara. And Yogacara is like it was a movement in India in like the middle of the first millennium that was very influential. And basically the idea of Yogacara was to bring together Theravadan and Mahayana teachings and show how they were distinct, but they could be harmoniously practiced together. So mindfulness in the Yogacara tradition is understood to be kind of the most powerful meditative tool available from the Theravadan tradition, which, as you may or may not know, is kind of the origin of the Insight school, as I understand it. So anyway, mindfulness, according to the kind of the great, the paragon of Yogacara, Vasubandhu, basically said there's two main things that get in the way of our ability to engage in liberation. And those are our afflictive emotions and our delusive thinking. And his argument is that mindfulness is really, really good at helping you dissolve patterns of painful emotional habituation what do you call afflictive emotion? Because, you know, our painful emotions not only are unpleasant to experience, but they tend to motivate us to do things that are less beneficial. So he says, mindfulness is really good for dealing with afflictive emotion. And Mahayana, this emphasis on intimacy or non-duality or interdependence or emptiness, however you want to frame it, is really effective at helping us cut through the delusion of our alienation, that we are these ultimately separate things trying to fight our way through a world that we can control and manipulate. And if you think that language doesn't sound true to your experience, I just check out your mind a little more. Come back. We can talk about it. So people are really various in my experience. And in the way we experience or recognize intimacy is quite various as well. I like to say it's individual and state dependent. So what I'm talking about in this book is that basically when we are more aware of connection, we are realizing intimacy, so we're moving closer to what reality is. And the more alienated we feel, or the more focused on control we are further from intimacy, and we're further from recognizing what is real. And we're all different. So that's what I talk about now, is our differentness. So like me, I really feel deeply connected when I get into environments where the phenomenon I see are not made by or for human beings. That is to say, what we would normally call nature. So like when I was coming over here, I'm staying with my friend in Silver Spring, and I came over and I was like, oh, sweet. I'll just stop in Rock Creek Park. I'll get down by the creek and walk around in the woods. There was no one there. There were deer. And I just felt, my mind quieted down. I felt connected. And, you know, I have a couple days off. I got to go back to Cleveland in a couple days because I'm on like a 3-week teaching tour. And I have 2 days off. I'm like immediately already planning the mountains I'm going to go camp in. And in that environment, I naturally feel my connection to the world. My mind quiets down. My activity becomes more flowing. I feel my sense of being supported and supporting. So I feel this intimacy is great. And, you know, there's probably some people in this room who are like, yeah, feeling that. But you know, when I did the first talk for this on this book back at my Zen Center afterwards, my friend came up and he said, I don't know, man, nature's not really that great. I was like, I don't really know. I mean, sometimes my wife makes me go on a nature walk. He doesn't feel that at all. It's not like universal. Or let's take like family. So like some people, they're like, all I gotta do is get with my family. And I feel whole, I feel supported, I feel like my energy flows to support them naturally, and it just feels so complete and good. And I was talking about this in Santa Barbara a couple months ago, and this woman just yelled, that's not really possible. I've heard tell. So yeah, people are different. People are different. And so this book is really designed around the idea that you can... We start to value my intimacy understood in this way, and you look at your life and you go, here's where I feel intimacy naturally. This is a place where I can draw strength. I can see how this is something I value and I can build on. And then you look at the parts of your life where you feel really alienated and you go, I could learn to find a more of a sense of intimacy in this situation. Because this is the basic message of Buddhism. You're not a victim of your karma. You don't just have to repeat the habits that your mind happens to be making. You have agency. So you can learn to find intimacy in all kinds of places where you really never thought you could. And I can guarantee that's true because, well, from my experience, I rarely talk about this. I'm not naturally good at intimacy. I just have to practice a lot. So I'm from Minnesota. You know. So I'm from Minnesota, so I get to talk about Prince when I give Dharma talks. Actually, you could too. When you give Dharma talks, even though you're not from Minnesota, I'm going to authorize you. It's the transmission I'm giving tonight. So Prince, you could watch Prince play music. And if you watch Prince play music, To me, this was my impression, and I think I was not alone. You would see Prince disappear into the activity of singing, dancing, exhorting the audience, and playing the guitar, the whole of it. He just, like, all the way there. You felt this deep sense of absorption in his activity. And this is one of the main ways in the Zen tradition that we value cultivating intimacy, is to just do whatever we're doing with our whole being. So, like, we do a lot, like, sweeping and, like, dusting. So I'm kind of the prince of sweeping and dusting. You could see this. So because you could see it, people would go, like, many thousands of people would go into a room, and they would watch this person, Prince Rogers Nelson, hurl himself into the activity, and then they would be drawn into this sense of connection and wholeness. I mean, people had profound spiritual experiences in the space of that environment. So, like, a person can not only realize or move towards intimacy through activity, but they can help other people to do it. They can help other people to do it. All of you already do this to some degree. How cool is that? I believe that. My whole being. And I would argue, like, the function of a Buddhist teacher is principally to do this thing, to realize intimacy and to help other people open up into intimacy mutually. But, you know, Prince died alone in an elevator of a drug overdose when he was 58 years old. And this also shows us something about intimacy, which is people may have an amazing capacity to open up into something very vast and also be profoundly wounded and alienated in other parts of their life. This is not only something that can happen, but it's actually pretty common. It's actually pretty common, I think. Everybody is like this. We have a constellation of tendencies around intimacy. We have those places where we're very wounded. You're like, I was just talking to a friend of mine. He's like, yeah, it's like my family. It's great. I hang out with my wife. We have so much fun. And then this one thing happens. And then it's just like someone dumped gas on us. Boom. So this is a human condition. So it's not like, I think some Buddhist literature might kind of point to the idea that you kind of realize intimacy really good once and then you're all set. It just doesn't seem to work out that way to me. I don't know. If it works out that way for you, I'd love to hear about it. Really? That's great. So anyway, we can just keep growing. We can look into those places and we don't have to judge ourselves. Ah, I screwed everything up. Yep. I'm human. What did the founder of my school of Buddhism, Dogen Zenji, founded Soto Zen, he said, the life of a Zen master is one mistake after another. So I'm going to read you a little bit here. So this book is divided into chapters that are just about, like, basic parts of our lives. I'm getting a really good opportunity to practice mindful of my left ear tonight. This is cool. The book is divided into just, like, things like body, mind, heart, family, work, play, sex, romance, ritual, community, nature, stuff like that. Parts of our lives, and then the idea is you can just look at it, like, how can I use mindfulness to cultivate intimacy in this part of my life? What it comes down to. Anyway, I want to read just the first couple paragraphs from this chapter on heart. Have you ever seen someone laughing in the rain? Or someone stoop-shouldered, shuffling along on a green and sunny day? Perhaps in a time of crisis, you've seen someone respond with resolve and energy, and someone else collapse into fear or despair. Maybe someone you know gets testy, and then you know it's best to leave them alone. When a loved one is dying, sometimes people are overwhelmed with pain and can barely take care of their basic needs. And sometimes they leap into frantic action to avoid their feelings. And at other times, they only know one thing, profound, all-encompassing acceptance and love. I've seen all this in others and in myself as well. One of the clearest insights of my years of meditation is how powerfully my emotions color my experience, my perception of the world. So I put an amazing amount of time studying this Yogacara text called the 30 Verses on Consciousness Only. And it's this really beautiful model for how to understand consciousness and how to transform it so people can be more free from suffering. And in the middle, there's these long lists of phenomena like faith, energy, compassion, nonviolence, anger, arrogance, harmfulness, lack of faith, distraction. It's long lists of all these phenomena. And I knew a lot of Zen people who liked this text because it's really influential in Zen. And they would get to the part with the long list and they'd just be like, I don't know. I have no idea what to do with that. I don't like lists. I don't know how you are with lists, but Zen people are like really down on the list part of Buddhism. It's a lot of right brain folks. Anyway, so I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with these lists. And I'm like writing a book about this. What can I do? Blah, blah, blah. And then I had a blinding flash of the obvious because I realized Vasubandhu puts in this text this list of 50 phenomena. And he's like, here's what experience is like. And there's maybe 50 or 60 phenomena. And like 2/3 of them are emotional. And I finally realized, I think Vasubandhu thinks it's important to know how I feel. It's almost like if you had a tradition that was entirely based on alleviating suffering, how you feel would be important. Amazing. So I just thought, well, this makes sense because I personally, 60% of my mental energy is always invested in being mindful of my feeling states. No. Maybe 4. How much is it? I don't know. You know, I was like to think like when you're anxious, you're just like, you don't really, how many of us really know the feeling of anxiety deeply as a feeling state? Mostly we're just like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Oh my goodness. Or the simplest way I like to put it is when you're angry, rarely do you know anger as a feeling state. You just know someone else is a dick. So this isn't absolutely true, but it's a real tendency. So human consciousness is conditioned to not notice feelings and objectify and project. So because we're conditioned to think that what will work for us is to manipulate external objects. And Buddhism relentlessly, in almost every possible case, emphasizes your action rather than the result. Focusing on the action rather than the result. And the first point of action that I recommend is knowing how you feel. Because if you don't know how you feel, you don't even know why you're acting. People without awareness of feelings tend to just kind of, Mingyur Rinpoche likes to say, it's like you're a zombie. You're just like an automaton. Karma automaton. Wow, never thought of that before. Anyway, so Yogacara gives a really concise and clear model of how to understand why mindfulness of emotions is such a powerful tool for transforming and shedding emotional habits and doing something liberative for the world. And I will try and sum it up briefly. If you've ever read anything by Thich Nhat Hanh, you'll be like, wait a minute, that's Thich Nhat Hanh stuff. That's because Thich Nhat Hanh is teaching Yogacara lots and lots. So anyway, from the Yogacara model, when there's an emotional state, there is a seed planted in consciousness, and there will be similar emotional state later. So any emotional state that comes up that's not seen mindfully will plant another seed, and you will, at some point, someone will experience a similar emotional state. Because all things are interdependent, you may experience the emotional state, or someone else might. It might happen in 500 lifetimes, it might happen in 17 kalpas, or it might happen in 5 seconds. So that part, because we're in intimacy, is beyond control. But what will happen is that feeling state will recur. Because in the way they describe it is the seed bears fruit. So a seed of anger plants a seed of anger, the fruit will be anger. So mindfulness allows you to do something different. So normally, like when there's the anger and I'm just thinking about if someone else is a terrible person, I'm not aware of the emotional process at all. So it's happening unconsciously. So down here, somewhere in the non-known part of consciousness, there's just these seeds of anger being planted and seeds bearing fruit, being planted, bearing fruit. I don't even know any of that's going on, and I'm just like, ah, that, rah, 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 rah. On the other hand, if I am deeply aware of the feeling state itself, that is to say, if I'm mindful of it, what happens is the previous seed of anger bears fruit. So I have to experience the anger. Sorry. You got to be you. It's your life. You get to be there with anger, but the thing is, it bears fruit. And instead of just planting another similar seed, it's been seen. That fruit came into awareness. It's done. The seed that is planted is the seed of compassionate awareness, which is also known as mindfulness of emotions. If you can just see the feeling, what you've done is you've planted a seed of compassionate awareness into the world. Into the world. And if you're like me, you're like, could I just get the fruit of that compassionate seed of awareness like tomorrow? Or like in 5 minutes? You know, you're like meditating. You're like, why am I not getting more calm? This isn't about getting more calm. It's about giving your life to the liberation of everyone. This is much more radical than getting more calm or getting something for yourself. Much more radical. So just to be mindful of your emotional states is a profound and powerful offering to the world. Because people, you know, you read the news and you're like, how can those people do that? They're like you. They're like me. They're just people with a lot of conditioning. Most of them think they're doing something really helpful. Someone's probably sitting around going, what are those morons doing at the UU church? We're trying our best. Oh, can't resist just bringing Audre Lorde back into the room again. On the subject of how we pay attention is a transformative offering for the world. Audre Lorde once wrote, the quality of light by which we scrutinize our lives has a direct bearing on the product we live and the changes we hope to bring about through our lives. The way we look at our lives has a profound influence on what we will do and what will go out into the world. And the way that we're invited to look at ourselves is with compassion. This is a powerful seed to plant. So I want to read another little bit here. And this, you know, when I prepare to like go out and talk about a book, it's got to figure out what you're going to talk about. You know, I have to go, what part should I read? And I'm just going to be honest. I decided to read this because it's about someone who I really love and I think is really great. So that's like at the bottom. So Tomoe Katagiri was the first person in the United States to teach the sewing of Soto Zen ritual garments, which is itself a traditional way of expressing Buddhism. So... and now there are many, many people who their main mode of Buddhist practice is sewing garments like these. That's my practice, or the people who are teachers, and their main teaching is teaching people how to sew with their whole being. They're the princes of sewing. And Tomoe, she is the widow of Dainin Katagiri, who founded the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. I'm in the Katagiri lineage. Anyway, she's in... Dainin Katagiri died almost 25 years ago, but Tomoe is still doing well and is very wonderful. Anyway, I'll read you a little story about Tomoe. This is from the chapter called Teachers. Tomoe Katagiri taught me well, mostly by staying by my side and quietly pouring her energy into what we were doing together. Tomoe-san helped bring the art of sewing Zen monks' robes from Japan to the United States, and she was my teacher in sewing the robes that symbolized my ordination. She gave me precise instruction on the technical aspects of sewing, with which I am far from adept. I forgot to mention, I really like to celebrate sewing practice, but I don't like doing it at all. I'm terrible at it. Anyway, but I try. So anyway, she gave me precise instruction, but to me, her real teaching lay in her embodiment of patience, attention to the present moment, and quiet, warm intimacy. It was not uncommon as we worked side by side for us to be silent for an hour at a time to support wholehearted focus on each stitch. After the entire robe is sewn, which took me about a year, it is carefully ironed and folded, precisely like origami. Ironed and folded. I frequently found the sewing process frustrating, but she just calmly stitched away beside me. I recall the moment when I finished the final stitch, a moment I had been waiting for. I said, "Tomoy, I finished the robe." I was ready for a birthday cake, or maybe some fireworks. She put down her sewing and moved to stand up as she said, "I'll turn on the iron." I don't think she was consciously teaching me, but she brought me right back to what was in front of me. She modeled not living for some other time when the current task, the current manifestation of life, is done. She hadn't been waiting for me to finish, and she realized nothing is ever really finished. Life goes on. All things connect. She took care of the world by focusing on the life at hand, and that was teaching enough for me. So, the life at hand can be a lot of different things. The life at hand can be like putting your feet on the ground when you wake up in the morning. It can be actually sitting down on a cushion or a chair to just be with your body, your breath. The life at hand can be standing in the street with thousands of people, as it was for me on Friday, who are youngsters, while they say, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, climate change has got to go." You can show up for anything, but the way you show up is what's most important, the quality of action. This is the energy that we put into the world is what will be reproduced. And so you can do this in small things and big things, but they're all just the thing you're doing. So there's nothing really big or small. The whole world shows up in every moment, and you have an opportunity. Well, thank you all very much. I like to hear other people talk. You might think that I just like to talk all the time myself, but I actually really like to hear other people talk. So I left a few minutes here in the hopes that people would say things. Questions are welcome, or answers, comments, experiences.
I just wanted to know about why you chose Zen.
Okay, we might not need the mic because that was a short question. Why did I choose Zen? This is very mysterious. So I'll give an answer that's kind of flippant, but kind of true. I came to meditation because I was in emotional crisis. I'm a recovering drug addict and alcoholic, and I had managed to stop drinking, but I was still profoundly mentally ill and terrible at being in relationship to people. And so I was like, I got to do something more. And so I was like going to therapy, and I thought, I'll try meditation. And so I'm like, well, where do they meditate? There's a Zen center a half mile from my house. And I walked over there, and the people were nice, and I still practice and teach there 15 years later. So on the one hand, it's like I'm really, really fortunate that there just happened to be something that was very convenient. But I will say that Zen, I love the literary tradition of Zen. So I'm a literary-minded person, and so the poetry of it, the koan literature, which is kind of wild and opaque, just speaks to my heart. So I love that. But, you know, I love my teacher. I met a person who was very supportive to me. His name's Tim Burkett. And the intimacy of that relationship was transformative for me. So it is people, probably, more than anything. Thank you for the question.
There's been a lot of talk in Tricycle and others about fast food Buddhism, fast food meditation.
Mindfulness?
Mindfulness.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, and I have felt that too sometimes, and I'm sure that it was Tara's wisdom in inviting you here to bring a broader spectrum of Buddhism to us. And I just wondered what thoughts you had about sometimes the focus is to go to bliss, and when rather than the deepness of you're going to experience the good and the bad, the happiness and the sorrow, the suffering. Mm-hmm. I just wondered what your thoughts were on that aspect of where this mass movement is headed.
Yeah, well, I would say that the most important thing to me is we all are a part of it, so it's like we have a little agency within it. And the main thing is I want to just keep putting the message, this is an altruistic tradition. It's not about getting something for yourself. It's about giving something away. And so, I mean, if you know, meditation that helps people be calm helps. You know, people, it will help if people calm down a little bit. But it's the context. So, like, within Soto Zen, our practice is like, we just sit and it's called just sitting. There's not even an object of concentration. We just are. But the framing is, why are we doing that? To liberate all beings from suffering. And we keep calling to mind this aspiration to pour our lives into liberation. And that changes how we are. And that aspect of it, however it's framed within this community, is what we want to make sure is being brought into any kind of secular mindfulness movement.
I realize that Prince, one way to lose self and non-self is to totally get into something. Could you describe how, not that process, because that can happen periodically, but how do people find that in a constant way?
Well, to me, like, if you want to cultivate intimacy to make it more pervasive in your life, it does take both building on where you want to look at your own experience and recognize, oh, I feel more connected here. That's good. And then look at your own experience and be like, ah, I feel really kind of cut off. One of the simplest things is when you're really focused on control, you're getting a long way from realizing intimacy. So, and then you can just start to challenge those tendencies. And so there's like a lot of methodologies. The book as a whole, like, you know, it's like a big project. But at the bottom, you know, you can start to know how you feel, know your body. That will begin to enable you to see through the conditioning that makes you feel so alienated, and then really open up that mindfulness to other people. And then go beyond mindfulness, because mindfulness is object-based. And move into realizing something beyond being separate from the person. But the mindfulness kind of opens the door. So you can carry it into those places where you really feel not intimate and start to find connection through there. Maybe one more if someone wants to say something.
So it sounds like you're saying that it's the intent, right? Maybe the energy, the intent of what we're trying to do when we are in that mindfulness moment. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's pretty well put. So in the Pali Canon, it's mm-hmm. karma, Buddha says very specifically, karma is intention, mm-hmm. period. So, but what is confusing about that is, like, people go, well, wait a minute, like, say I used to be a drug addict. So I'd be like, I intended to not use, and then I used all the time. So intention in that phrase, when he says karma intention, intention means something different than we use to understand. Intention means the stuff that causes you to do what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And usually we're not aware of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So mindfulness is a tool that allows you to be aware of the intentional stuff that's driving your behavior, which is also called karma. But you can also actively cultivate certain kinds of intention. And you do that within the context of being mindful. So, like, when I'm like, beings are numberless, vowing to freedom, I'm like pouring my attention into it. So that's permeating my consciousness with that kind of intention, that intentional energy. And then it's just given away. And I may or may not experience the fruits of that karma. I hope I don't need to. I want everyone to be free.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
So that's enough for me. I want everyone to be free, but we're not. So let's just keep going. Thank you all very much.